Good afternoon, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier. It's Monday, October 4th. I'm your reader, Bob Young. We're looking at a sunny day today with a high of only 74 degrees. Winds will be from the northeast between 6 and 12 miles per hour. As we look around the region, sunny and nice today, partly cloudy tonight, partly sunny and pleasant tomorrow. Wednesday will be cloudy to partly sunny. Thursday, cloudy most of the time, with a passing shower. Friday, very warm, with clouds and sun. Our sun rose this morning at 7:10 a.m., and it will set tonight at 6:46 p.m. We'll have a new moon in 2 days on the 6th. The lead stories on the front page today include Whitfer maps our only topic Tuesday, Great Pumpkins, and For Many Farmers, Yields Are Better Than Expected. Let's begin with the pumpkin story. This was filed by Melody Parker. Melody's subtitle is Good Gourd, Cedar Valley Pumpkin Crop Ripe for the Picking. And the story is replete with beautiful orange pumpkins all lined up. And she begins, Hello, gorgeous. Bright orange, saucy red, ghostly white. Pumpkins are a sign that it's time to carve out some fun. Pumpkin patches are ripe for picking, and farmers' markets and grocery stores are carrying their weight in fall's favorite vegetable for jack-o'-lanterns, autumn decor, and dessert making. The harvest is turning out to be a good one for local growers. In spite of dry conditions and spats of heavy rain, Iowa ranks 27th on the list of pumpkin acres harvested, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Rick and Julie Kiefer, owners of Kiefer Farms, 4881 Texas Street, Waterloo, are enjoying a fine pumpkin season so far. The weather has been good for their crop. Quote, We plant 4 to 5 acres in pumpkins each year. Actually, pumpkins prefer hot and dry weather, and we've had rain at opportune times, and we irrigate. We've had to irrigate only a couple of times this year. Pumpkins are really good-sized and solid, said Julie. Growing pumpkins has been a proud tradition for 59 years at the fourth generation Kiefer Farms, the first pumpkin farm in Waterloo. They began lining up pumpkins of all shapes and sizes in their yard around mid-September because interest is high. Rick usually plants 7 different varieties of all shapes, sizes, and colors, including tried and true varieties and a handful of new hybrids each year. For carving jack-o'-lanterns, Rick said customers are looking toward the bigger varieties, such as Magic Lantern, a globe-shaped pumpkin averaging 16 to 24 pounds, Zeus, a large, round, dark orange pumpkin that can weigh as much as 30 pounds, is another popular choice, Julie said. Kiefer also sells pie pumpkins, varieties of squash, mums, cornstalk bundles, and bales of hay. Family activities include a haunted walk, hay rides, haunted house, and animal nursery. Dave Myers, owner of Heartland Farms, 5111 Osage Road, a mile north of Elk Run Heights, said he expects to harvest 6,000 to 8,000 pumpkins this fall. Quote, I have 10 acres planted in pumpkins, and 8 of those acres I irrigated this year. I ended up with healthy plants and plenty of pumpkins, and I didn't have any field loss, he explained. Heartland Farms offers a variety of family activities through October 31st, including Scarecrow's Haunted Barn, a haunted cornfield, treehouse tube slide, pumpkin playland, hay rides, farm animals, and the Pumpkinator that blasts pie-sized pumpkins against an old school bus. He grows 20 or more varieties of varying sizes, from carvers that weigh in at about 30 pounds to sugar pumpkins with soft, dense flesh for dessert making, and specialty pumpkins that can fit in the palm of your hand. And at the other end, we have some pumpkins that weigh near 100 pounds. He also grows squash, including butternut and acorn, and decorative gourds. The pumpkin carving tradition came from the Irish custom of carving jack-o'-lanterns out of turnips and potatoes, and lighting them with embers to chase away evil spirits. Irish immigrants brought the custom to America in the 1800s and began using pumpkins. Quote, people are interested in different colors and shapes. You've got some traditional orange pumpkins that are perfect for carving, and some that are destined for the front steps, Myers said. Color selections can range from the classic shades of jack-o'-lantern orange for carvers to white, tan, pink, green, rouge, red, blue, brilliant red, and stripes. Shapes are rotund, flat, round, pear, and tall. Some skins are smooth. Others are warty or mottled. Some ribs are flat and elongated, and others are deeply carved. Quote, this year, the big thing is stacking squatty pumpkins, Julie Kiefer said. Her customers are stacking pumpkins in contrasting colors, which can be displayed on the ground, surrounded by colorful mums, or stacked in urn flower pots. How long a carved pumpkin will last outdoors, quote, depends on the weather and how warm it is, usually 2 to 5 days, she said. You can pick a pumpkin early and store it in a cool, dry place out of sunlight until ready to carve. Then do your carving about a week before Halloween. Quote, and if there's a cold snap, make sure the pumpkin doesn't freeze, because when it thaws, it will rot. You can cover it outdoors with a sheet or something other than plastic. Plastic traps moisture and can cause the pumpkin to deteriorate more quickly. Uncarved pumpkins can last 1 month or much longer if kept out of the sun and away from moisture and freezing temperatures. For more information and details about Halloween happenings, go to www.kieferfarmsia.com or www.heartlandfarmswaterloo.com. Our next story was filed by Rod Bossert of the Gazette. For many Iowa farmers, crop yields are better than expected. Des Moines. For the multitude of Iowa corn and soybean farmers teeming with harvest hopes, it's go time. From satellite-guided mega machines to old-school combines and corn pickers, farmers are greased and ready to roll as dusty clouds arise from the Iowa landscape. And here we have a couple of beautiful pictures of the harvest. We see a combine from a distance, but it is shot straight on, and you see the cloud of dust billowing behind the combine as it moves through the field. And we also have an aerial shot taken from a drone and showing probably the same combine, and we can see it moving through the field and billowing dust behind it. Quote, I think this week, the way the weather is cooperating and looking with some heat, folks are really going to get out and go hard and really get harvest underway, said Iowa Agriculture Secretary Mike Nyag. He took a break from combining soybeans at his family's Palo Alto County operation last week to discuss 2021 harvest prospects. Despite dry conditions in much of Iowa this year, Nyag said farmers he's talked with indicate yields should be better than expected. Quote, we're really terribly dry up here, but I have to say we're pleasantly surprised with how yields are looking, even given how dry it was, Nyag said. But across the state, it really is kind of a mixed bag. It's all weather dependent. There were parts of the state that were terribly dry. You actually had parts of southeast Iowa that were really too wet. And then you had some that got timely rain, and they got just enough. I think we're going to see some record yields in parts of the state. So it'll be another year where you're going to have a lot of variability. But I think generally, we can say things look better than we might have expected, unquote. With market prices for a bushel of corn topping $5 and soybeans approaching $13 per bushel, farmers who are whipsawed by global trade uncertainties, COVID-19, and a rare crop flattening derecho are looking at a bounce back year with expectations they'll finish number one nationally in corn production and second to Illinois in soybean production in 2021. Mark Licht, an associate professor and cropping systems specialist with Iowa State University Extension and Outreach, said there is early push to harvest soybeans. A dry growing season with warm temperatures and low humidity has dried grain rapidly. On the corn side, farmers may spend considerably less on drying as plants mature in the field. Quote, field activity has ramped up incredibly fast this year. We went from basically not harvesting to everyone harvesting as fast as they possibly can, largely because grain moistures have dropped really quickly. Both corn and soybean dry downs have been really good, Licht said. Quote, I would guess that by the end of the week, we will have farmers telling us that they are done with soybeans and they're moving on to corn, he noted. We might see that soybean harvest rate quite a bit higher than normal, unquote. Overall, the U.S. crop expert expects the harvest will finish up a little earlier than usual. The latest projections from the U.S. Department of Agriculture peg Iowa's soybean yield at 58 bushels per acre, up from three previous years, but below the 60.5 bushels an acre state record for 2016. For corn, the August estimate expected yields to average 193 bushels per acre, below the 2018 record of 204. ISU Extension agronomists report yield ranges from 145 to 225 bushels around Iowa, with concerns over the stock quality in dried-out plants susceptible to wind damage. Yields will be variable and all over the map, Nag said. Harvest was underway last week for most eastern Iowa farmers. Jeff Knupp, 59, who grows corn and soybeans near Garrison in Benton County, was pleased with how his beans were looking from the combine on September 24th. Quote, real good, he said. This field we're in now appears to be yielding 80 bushels per acre. Knupp, who farms 650 acres, got timely rain this summer. He was able to plant earlier than usual, which means an early harvest. He plans to do a fall application of nitrogen fertilizer once the ground is cold, but before it freezes. When harvest is late, there's not always time for fertilizer before the snow falls. Quote, if the weather stays good, we'll be done with beans in 10 to 12 days, Knupp said. Then corn will be another 20 days. Dan Delaney, 44, who farms about 600 acres in Jefferson County, hadn't yet started harvesting on September 27th. He wanted to give his crops a few more days to mature in the field, but it made him a little anxious when he drove over to southern Illinois recently and saw some farmers had their crops completely out of the field. Quote, we're going to get started this week on some of this corn, he said. We raise cattle too, and we've been kind of getting some of the cattle stuff taken care of so we don't have to stop harvesting the corn once we get started. Southeast Iowa planting was a little behind schedule because of spring rains, Delaney said. A windstorm September 20 flattened some of his corn. He'll have to harvest in one direction, opposite of the way the corn fell, because he doesn't have special equipment to lift up the slanted stalks. Delaney also worries about equipment breakdowns because of supply chain issues worldwide. Quote, it's been kind of a crazy year, he said. Delaney harvests with a neighbor. While they're bringing in the corn and chopping it for cattle feed for his herd and his neighbor may start harvesting soybeans from both farms. While drought conditions in northern Iowa were bad throughout the summer, Clear Lake farmer Chris Peterson speculated it may not have a huge impact on the fall harvest. Peterson said corn that was planted early was harmed pretty bad by the drought, but corn planted later in the summer wasn't impacted as heavily. Quote, the longer-term corn seems to be doing pretty decent, Peterson said. The drought didn't impact the longer-term maturity corn, unquote. Peterson said that part of the reason for this was due to rain late in the summer season. Quote, that was $1 million an acre rain, Peterson said. It saved a lot of crops and saved a lot of guys. Despite early drought conditions, Peterson speculates that it will still be a good fall harvest. Quote, it's going to be a good year, Peterson said. It's going to be a good year for everybody. Nag and Licht said areas of Iowa hard hit by August 10, 2020 derecho battled problems this year of volunteer corn appearing in soybean fields and other places where the downed grain re-emerged during the growing season. But I think by and large, these folks had a pretty good year, said Meg. Harvest is still early, but the yields we've been hearing in the last 2 or 3 weeks, I think the producers are generally surprised that things are exceeding their expectations. So overall, I think the 2021 crop yields are going to be good, said Matt Vegter, a real estate agent in Nevada who specializes in farmland sales. Northwest Iowa farmers are seeing a wide range of yields, all depending on how much rain fell on an area of the state that experienced varying degrees of drought. But what little rain did fall in some areas came at an opportune time in late July and August, giving crops a boost and surprising farmers who have been making rapid progress this week on the bean harvest. Quote, if you've got that rainfall, yields are better than people thought they'd be. Even in the stressed areas, they're pleasantly surprised with how their yields are doing, said Joel DeYoung, an Iowa State University Extension and Outreach field agronomist based in Lamar's. I think the average is going to be decent, but the range is going to be wide, unquote. DeYoung said fields that received those timely rains are yielding 80 bushels of beans per acre. Most farmers are seeing bean yields in the 60s and 70s. Drier areas are down to the 50s and lower. He said the area's yields are average to slightly above average. Quote, it's mixed, he said. We have some parts of the area that have some nice rain, and they're having really nice yields, unquote. Chuck White was one of those farmers to benefit from the rain at the right time. The 710 acres of corn and beans he farms near Spencer with his son Patrick and brother Kevin is doing well, thanks in part to 9 inches of rain that fell from July 10th to September 10th. Quote, I'm extremely happy. It was the timeliness of the rain. When we got the rain, it was just in time. Anytime you get any rain at all, it was really a gift, said White, a director for the Iowa Soybean Association. Quote, that August rain, that really helped the soybeans. Anybody that was under a cloud, they got a good yield, unquote. White said his beans so far are yielding a bit above average, with fields producing 60 bushels and into the 70s per acre. He had yet to start on the corn crop. DeYoung said not enough corn has been harvested to accurately gauge this year's crop. He suspects it will be similar to the bean crop, with yields varying according to the amount of rain received. Okay, now on the last front page article, we have Whitfer. Maps are our only topic Tuesday. GOP leader sees session on one issue only, redistricting. Story is filed by Rob Bossart and begins with the photograph of Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitford, Republican from Ankeny. Des Moines, the top Republican in the state Senate, says his members are upset by a federal overreach from the Democratic Biden administration, but expects to deal only with redistricting this week when the GOP-led legislature meets in special session. Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitfer, Republican of Ankeny, said he has been talking with senators in his 32-member caucus to gauge support for the new election boundaries for congressional and legislative districts drawn by the nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency, and plans to make his recommendation in closed caucus when lawmakers convene on Tuesday. He did not indicate what he will recommend, other than that the legislature abide by the rules spelled out in Iowa law that prescribe lawmakers must take an up or down vote on the new maps and seek a second version from the agency if they reject the first. Because results from the 2020 census were delayed, lawmakers will be working under a tight timeline set by the Iowa Supreme Court. Quote, as with all pieces of legislation that we consider, we'll make a final decision when we go to caucus on Tuesday, Whitfer said Friday. Quote, we'll gavel in at 10, we'll go to the caucus and make a final decision on the map. Quote, a number of our members have expressed concerns with the map. Other members have seen positive aspects of the map, and so we'll have that caucus and make that final decision as a team on Tuesday, he added. Three Republican senators, Jason Schultz of Schleswig, Ken Rosenblum of Oskaloosa and Annette Sweeney of Alden all insisted they do not know whether the first set of approved maps will pass. Under the proposed legislative election maps, Schultz and Sweeney would be drawn into new districts along with a fellow Republican incumbent senator. Quote, you know, everybody would like to have that crystal ball. Even we legislators don't have that, Sweeney said. Quote, it's part of the process. I've been through it before. I respect the process. So I think we'll just have to wait until we get there on Tuesday, unquote. Representative Jennifer Confirst, Democrat from Windsor Heights, who leads the minority Iowa House Democrats, said her sense is that the Republican majorities will approve this first set of proposed maps. If there is any trepidation among Republicans, she said, it's coming from the Senate. Quote, we're hearing that there is a little bit of consternation in the Senate about what they want to do with the maps, Confirst said during her first appearance on this weekend's episode of Iowa Press on Iowa PBS. But this can be a bipartisan vote if people are willing to take Democratic votes, and we can help get this done. While senators are hearing concerns from their constituents over mask mandates and education-related topics, the Senate GOP leader said he expects this week's special session will be confined to consideration of the proposed redistricting maps only, and likely be completed in a day. Quote, I would say this. Our members are very concerned about massive federal overreach from this failing Biden agenda, and our members are searching for ways to help Iowans who are concerned about this federal overreach, Whitfer said. But currently, we don't have any other legislation prepared. While the Republican majorities will set the special session agenda, Confirst said her feeling also is that lawmakers will focus solely on redistricting. Quote, I sure hope next Tuesday is boring, she said. We have January, the regular 2022 legislative session. It's not that far away. We can bring up all these issues then. I don't get the sense that there are a lot of members who are thrilled about coming back for the special session day after day after day. It's the harvest. We all have day jobs that we need to get back to. So my sense is that we want to make this a day-long session and go about our business. So that is my hope and expectation. The next story we read is filed by the Associated Press. No winner. Biggest Powerball jackpot in months grows larger. Des Moines. The biggest lottery prize in months grew larger after no ticket matched all five numbers and the Powerball drawn on Saturday night. The estimated jackpot for the next drawing on Monday is $670 million. Saturday night's numbers were 28, 38, 42, 47, and 52, and the Powerball was 1. The Powerball jackpot has slowly climbed thanks to 40 consecutive drawings without a grand prize winner, a record streak for the game dating back to June 5th. There hasn't been a bigger Powerball jackpot since $731.1 million prize was won on January 20th. Saturday's grand prize of $635 million would have been the 10th largest U.S. lottery jackpot ever won. Since August 23rd, Powerball drawings have been held three times a week to increase interest and grow prizes more quickly. Drawings are held each Monday, Wednesday, and Saturday at 10:59 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. One thing that hasn't changed, though, are the long odds of winning the jackpot, one in 292.2 million. The estimated jackpot amount refers to winners who opt to be paid through an annuity over 29 years. Most winners prefer the cash option, which for Monday's drawing would be an estimated $474.8 million before taxes. Powerball is played in 45 states, plus Washington, D.C., Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. This next story was filed by Bloomberg News. U.S. turning the corner on COVID surge, Fauci says. Washington. The U.S. is turning the corner on the most recent surge in COVID-19 cases, and more people need to get vaccinated to keep infections on a declining trend, infectious disease specialist Anthony Fauci said. Fauci, who is President Joe Biden's chief medical advisor, said that while the full vaccination rate has reached 55%, the key risk is the 70 million eligible people in the U.S. who haven't gotten a shot. Quote, we currently are turning the corner on this particular surge, Fauci said on ABC's This Week on Sunday. The way to keep it down, to make that turnaround continue to go down, is to do what we mentioned, get vaccinated. Study results showing that a Merck and Company experimental pill slashed the risk of getting seriously ill or dying from COVID-19 are very impressive, Fauci said on CNN's State of the Union. Quote, so we really look forward to the implementation of this and to its effect on people who are infected, he said. The pill is a big deal, he said on ABC. Merck agreed in June to a $1.2 billion deal with the U.S. government to supply 1.7 million courses of the treatment, which raises the possibility that many virus patients could be treated before reaching the hospital. Fauci said the government has, quote, the option for millions more. And now that we have this success, the company certainly is going to rev up and make tens and tens of millions more for the rest of the world and for us, he said on CBS's Face the Nation. U.S. deaths since the start of the pandemic surpassed 700,000 last week in what Biden called an astonishing death toll. That's yet another reminder of just how important it is to get vaccinated. Fauci dismissed attempts to blame immigrants and tourists as a major source of the spread of COVID in the U.S., a belief held by 37% of Americans overall and 55% of Republicans, according to a recent poll by the Kaiser Family Foundation. Quote, if you just look at the data and look at the people who have gotten infected, look at the people who are in the hospital, look at the people who died, this is not driven by immigrants, Fauci said on CNN's State of the Union. The Associated Press also filed this story about the coronavirus. Money mostly unspent. States have until the end of 2024 to make funding commitments. As Congress considered a massive COVID-19 relief package earlier this year, hundreds of mayors from across the U.S. pleaded for immediate action on billions of dollars targeted to shore up their finances and revive their communities. Now that they've received it, local officials are taking their time before actually spending the windfall. As of this summer, a majority of large cities and states hadn't spent a penny from the American Rescue Plan, championed by Democrats and President Joe Biden, according to an Associated Press review of the first financial reports due under the law. States had spent just 2.5% of their initial allotment, while large cities spent 8.5%, according to the AP analysis. Many state and local governments reported that they were still working on plans for their share of the $350 billion, which can be spent on a wide variety of programs. Though Biden signed the law in March, the Treasury Department didn't release the money and spending guidelines until May. By then, some state legislatures already had wrapped up their budget work for the next year, leaving governors with no authority to spend the new money. Cities sometimes delayed decisions while soliciting suggestions from the public, and some government officials, still trying to figure out how to spend previous rounds of federal pandemic aid, simply didn't see an urgent need for the additional cash. Quote, it's a lot of money that's been put out there. I think it's a good sign that it hasn't been frivolously spent, Louisville Mayor Greg Fisher said. He was president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors when more than 400 mayors signed a letter urging Congress to quickly pass Biden's plan. The law gives states until the end of 2024 to make spending commitments and the end of 2026 to spend the money. Any money not obligated or spent by those states must be returned to the federal government. The Biden administration said it isn't concerned about the early pace of the initiative. The aid to governments is intended both to address any crisis needs and to provide longer-term firepower to ensure a durable and equitable recovery, said Jean Sperling, White House American Rescue Plan Coordinator. Quote, the fact that you can spread your spending out is a feature, not a bug, of the program. It is by design, Sperling told the Associated Press. The Treasury Department set an aggressive reporting schedule to try to prod local planning. It required states, counties, and cities with estimated populations of at least 250,000 to file reports by August 31st, detailing their spending as of the previous month, as well as future plans. More than half of the states and nearly two-thirds of the roughly 90 largest cities reported no initial spending. The governments reported future plans for about 40% of their total funds. To promote transparency, the Treasury Department also required governments to post the reports on a prominent public-facing website, but the Associated Press found that many governments ignored that directive. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls The Courier for Monday, October 4th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to the sports page. In a story filed by the Associated Press, Cyclones dismantle Kansas in Jack Trice Stadium rout. Ames, Matt Campbell preaches complimentary football. That happened as Iowa State dismantled Kansas 59-7 on Saturday night in Jack Trice Stadium. The first quarter encapsulated the complimentary football Campbell would like to play. Each phase of the team made plays that allowed Iowa State to score 28 points in the first quarter. Iowa State started the game with an impressive 6-play, 70-yard drive, capped off by a 36-yard Brock Purdy to Xavier Hutchinson touchdown. On the following possession, Kansas quarterback Jason Bean fumbled the ball without being touched while trying to elude a pass rush. Defensive end Zach Peterson recovered the fumble. 2 plays later, Brock Purdy, while scrambling, found tight end Charlie Kolar in the back corner of the end zone, and Kolar somehow managed to keep a toe inbounds to complete the catch. Iowa State led 14-0 after 4 minutes and 27 seconds ran off the clock. After a Kansas turnover on downs on its next possession, Iowa State ran a play-action pass to Joe Skates, who didn't have a Kansas defender within 10 yards of him, for an easy 44-yard touchdown. Iowa State got its first 3 touchdowns in the span of 4 minutes, 23 seconds. Quote, I think it said a lot about our team to play the way we played. When we didn't get the result we wanted last week, ISU head coach Matt Campbell said, Kansas finally got an offensive drive going on its 4th possession and lined up for a field goal. But on the attempt, the 6'6" Enyi Uwazuriki blocked the field goal, which was returned 55 yards by Craig Ellsworth to the Iowa State 32-yard line. After a couple Brees Hill 10-plus yard runs, Purdy found running back Jarrell Brock for a 7-yard touchdown pass. Purdy started the game by completing his first 5 passes for 96 yards and 4 touchdowns. He also had 2 rushes for 24 yards on the first quarter. The 4 touchdown passes are the most ever in a quarter by a Cyclone. Purdy was undoubtedly incredible, but Hall also had 7 carries for 50 yards in the first quarter. After dominating the first quarter in every aspect, offense, defense, and special teams, the Cyclones cruised to the finish line. Purdy's day was done midway through the third quarter. He finished completing 17 of his 22 passes for 245 yards and 4 touchdowns. Purdy became the 6th Big 12 quarterback to push for over 10,000 yards and rush for over 1,000 in his career. Hall's day was done when Purdy's was, and he finished with 123 yards and 2 touchdowns on 17 carries. His first touchdown was his 37th career touchdown, the most touchdowns in school history. He passed Troy Davis and Dexter Green, who had 36 career touchdowns. Uwazuriki led the defense with 6 tackles and 0.5 tackles for a loss. He also had the special teams play of the day with the blocked kick. Iowa State put in its second string players for the last 20 minutes of the game. They picked up where the starters left off. Backup quarterback Hunter Deckers completed just 2 of his passes for 29 yards. Where Deckers did his damage, however, was with his legs. He had 2 rushes for 47 yards, including a 41-yard touchdown run. Backup running backs Eli Sanders and Deion Silas both did damage, too. Silas rushed the ball 3 times for 30 yards and a touchdown, and Sanders rushed the ball 4 times for 23 yards. Eric Olson of the Associated Press files this story about Iowa football. Iowa jumps to number 3 in latest Associated Press poll. Iowa is gearing up for its biggest home game since the 1980s. Cincinnati has its highest ranking in 12 years, and Clemson is on the outside looking in at the Associated Press college football poll for the first time since 2014. Alabama and Georgia are the only contestants during this topsy-turvy college football season. They held down the top 2 spots for a 5th straight week in the AP Top 25, which is presented by Regions Bank. Alabama received 53 of a possible 62 first-place votes Sunday, with Georgia picking up the rest. After those 2 teams, the movement up and down and in and out of the top 25 was about what would be expected after a week in which 9 ranked teams lost, including 4 in the top 10. During the first 5 weeks of the season, 34 ranked teams have lost, the most in poll history. Iowa leapfrogged Penn State to take the number 3 spot after its 51-14 road win over previously unbeaten Maryland. The Hawkeyes have their highest ranking since 2015. Penn State beat Indiana 24-0 at home and remained at number 4. Number 5 Cincinnati, coming off a 24-13 road win over Notre Dame, has its best ranking since Brian Kelly's 2009 Bearcats were number 4 in the first week of November. Oklahoma, Ohio State, Oregon, Michigan, and BYU round out the top 10. Midway through the season, it's strange that a rankings-based debate over the top 2 teams in the Big Ten doesn't include Ohio State. The Buckeyes very well may be the best, and the voters certainly show their respect by ranking them ahead of Oregon, despite a Week 2 home loss to the Ducks and a meh home win over Tulsa in the following game. This week's Penn State-Iowa clash is the Big Ten's game of the year so far. It will be the highest-ranked matchup in Iowa City since 1985, when the number 1 Hawkeyes beat number 2 Michigan 12-10 on a field goal as time ran out for what then Iowa coach Hayden Fry called the biggest win in program history. Number 4 Penn State at number 3 Iowa. This isn't the same Nittany Lions team that lost by 20 points to Iowa last year. Number 6 Oklahoma versus number 21 Texas. Red River rivalry will be hard-pressed to duplicate last year's 4 overtime thriller won by the Sooners. And number 13 Arkansas at number 17 Mississippi. These are a couple of teams looking for a reset after lopsided losses to the nation's best 2. And number 2 Georgia at number 18 Auburn. Bulldogs have won 12 of 15 in the series. Now here we have a recap of Sunday's football games with the title Murray Keeps Cardinals Unbeaten. Story filed by the Associated Press. Kyler Murray passed for 268 yards and 2 touchdowns and ran for 39 more yards in a virtuoso performance, and the Arizona Cardinals extended their longest unbeaten start since 2012 with a 37-20 victory over the Los Angeles Rams on Sunday. A.J. Green caught a 41-yard touchdown pass, Chase Edmonds ran for 120 yards, and James Conner rushed for two short scores for Arizona, which finally beat Sean McVay for the first time in 9 tries. Cliff Kingsbury's Cards did it with style, lighting up the Rams' defense for 465 total yards and scoring touchdowns after two early takeaways to affirm their arrival as a contender in the NFC West and beyond, despite playing 3 of their first 4 games on the road. Max Williams caught a touchdown pass from Murray, who went 24 for 32 and repeatedly frustrated the Rams' defense. Arizona's defense made several big plays, and it sealed the team's first victory over the Rams since January 1, 2017, by stopping Matthew Stafford and the LA offense on downs at the 1 with 12 minutes 5 seconds to play. Van Jefferson caught an early touchdown pass, and Robert Woods made a touchdown grab with 1 minute 14 to play. But Stafford was frequently off in his connections with his receivers. McVay regularly abandoned his running game despite Darrell Henderson's 89 yards, the second best performance of his career, on just 14 carries against a defense that hasn't stopped the run well this season. Los Angeles's defense had few answers for Murray, who consistently found open receivers or picked up his own yardage, while the Cardinals scored on 7 of 8 drives after an opening punt. Cowboys 36, Panthers 28. Dak Prescott threw 4 touchdown passes. Ezekiel Elliott had his first 100-yard rushing game of the season against the NFL's #1 defense, and Dallas beat Carolina in Arlington. Elliott finished with 143 yards and a touchdown on 20 carries as the Cowboys rolled up 245 yards on the ground after the Panthers allowed just 135 total in the first 3 games. Devon Diggs had 2 interceptions for an NFL leading 5 while becoming the first Dallas player with a pick in each of the first 4 games since the 1970 merger, when he won a tug-of-war with receiver DJ Moore for the 2nd pick. Diggs gave Dallas this year's NFL leader in forcing turnovers, multiple takeaways in an 8th consecutive game going back to last season, the longest active streak in the league. Colts 27, Dolphins 17. Carson Wentz threw a pair of touchdown passes to Mo Alley-Cox. Jonathan Taylor rushed for 103 yards, and a score, and Indianapolis got its first win of the season by topping sputtering Miami on the road. Chiefs 42, Eagles 30. Patrick Mahomes threw 5 touchdown passes 3 different ways, including 3 to Tyreek Hill, and Kansas City beat host Philadelphia. Bears 24, Lions 14. Rookie Justin Fields brushed off a nightmarish first start, and Chicago bounced back from one of the worst offensive performances the NFL has seen to beat winless Detroit at home. Bills 40, Texans 0. Linebacker Tremaine Edmonds had the first of Buffalo's 4 interceptions, and the host Bills suffocated offensively inept Houston. Browns 14, Vikings 7. Myles Garrett and the Cleveland defense produced another dominant performance, giving coach Kevin Stefanski a victory over his old team as the Browns won in Minneapolis. Giants 27, Saints 21 in overtime. Saquon Barkley ran for a 6-yard touchdown in overtime after Daniel Jones passed for a career-high 402 yards, and New York rallied for its first win of the season, beating New Orleans on the road. Washington 34, Falcons 30. Taylor Heinicke ad-libbed a 30-yard touchdown pass to J.D. McKissick with 33 seconds remaining, rallying Washington to a road victory over Atlanta. Jets 27, Titans 24 in overtime. Matt Amendola kicked a 22-yard field goal in overtime, and then Randy Bullock was wide left on a potentially tying 49-yarder with 15 seconds left to give New York its first victory in a win at home over Tennessee. Seahawks 28, 49ers 21. Russell Wilson overcame a shaky start to throw for two touchdowns and run for a third, and Seattle rebounded from back-to-back losses by beating San Francisco on the road. Packers 27, Steelers 17. Aaron Rodgers connected with Randall Cobb for two touchdowns and ran for another score as Green Bay won its third straight game, beating Pittsburgh at home. Ravens 23, Broncos 7. Lamar Jackson threw for 316 yards, including a 49-yard touchdown pass to a diving Marquise Brown, and Baltimore used a relentless defense to swat host Denver from the ranks of the unbeaten. Let's turn to some national news now. Oil pipeline shut down. Story filed by the Associated Press. Spill fouls shoreline with at least 126,000 gallons of crude. And the story begins with a photograph of masked cleanup contractors as they unload collected oil in plastic bags, trying to stop further oil crude incursion into the wetlands, Talbert Marsh, on Sunday in Huntington Beach, California. Huntington Beach, California, one of the largest oil spills in recent Southern California history, fouled popular beaches that could end up closed for months as crews scrambled Sunday to contain the crude before it spread further into protected wetlands. Divers were trying to determine where and why the leak occurred, but the flow of oil was stopped late Saturday from the pipeline that runs under the ocean off Huntington Beach, according to the head of the company that operates the line. At least 126,000 gallons of crude spilled into the waters off Orange County starting late Friday or early Saturday, when boaters began to report a sheen in the water, officials said. Quote, I don't expect it to be more. That's the capacity of the entire pipeline, said Amplify Energy CEO Martin Wilshire. He said the pipeline was suctioned out and dozens of nearby oil platforms operated by Amplify were shut down. It was one of the largest oil spills in recent Southern California history, fouling the strand in Huntington Beach, the town known as Surf City, USA. Crews scrambled to contain the crude before it spread to protected wetlands. Huntington Beach Mayor Kim Carr said the city's famous beaches would remain closed for weeks or even months. Quote, in a year that has been filled with incredibly challenging issues, this oil spill constitutes one of the most devastating situations that our community has dealt with in decades, Carr said. Quote, we are doing everything in our power to protect the health and safety of our residents, our visitors, and our natural habitats, unquote. The oil created a miles-wide sheen in the ocean and washed ashore in sticky black globules. Some birds and fish were caught in the muck and killed, said Orange County Supervisor Katrina Foley. But the U.S. Coast Guard said there was a report of just one ruddy duck that was covered in oil and receiving veterinary care. Quote, other reports of oiled wildlife are being investigated, the Coast Guard said in a statement. Crews led by the Coast Guard deployed skimmers and some 3,700 feet of floating barriers known as booms to try to stop further incursion into areas including Talbert Marsh, a 25-acre wetland in Huntington Beach, officials said. A petroleum stench permeated the air throughout the area. Quote, you get the taste in the mouth just from the vapors in the air, Foley said. The oil will likely continue to approach the Orange County coast, including Newport Beach to the south, over the next few days, officials said. The closure included all of the Huntington Beach from the city's north edge, about 6 miles south of the Santa Ana River jetty. The shutdown came amid summer-like weather that would have brought big crowds to the wide strand for volleyball, swimming, and surfing. Yellow caution tape was strung between lifeguard towers to keep people away. Officials canceled the final day of the annual Pacific Air Show that typically draws tens of thousands of spectators to Huntington Beach, a city of about 199,000 residents, about 30 miles south of downtown Los Angeles. The show featured flyovers by the U.S. Navy Blue Angels and the U.S. Air Force Thunderbirds. Now let's read the Digest column. North Korea warns UN on missile critiques. Seoul, South Korea. North Korea has warned the UN Security Council against criticizing the isolated country's missile program in a statement Sunday that included unspecified threats against the international body. During an emergency closed-door meeting of the top UN body Friday, France circulated a proposed statement that expresses concern over North Korea's missile launches and calls on it to fully implement Council resolutions that ban its ballistic missile firings. On Sunday, Jo Kul-soo, a senior North Korean foreign ministry official, warned the UN Council, quote, "It had better think what consequences it will bring in the future in case it tries to encroach upon the sovereignty of North Korea." Jo also accused the UN body of a double-dealing standard because it doesn't equally take issue with similar weapons tests by the United States and its allies, according to the statement circulated by state media. After a six-month hiatus, North Korea resumed missile tests in September, launching newly developed missiles, including nuclear-capable weapons that place South Korea and Japan, both key U.S. allies, within their striking distances. Bomb kills five civilians in Kabul. Kabul, Afghanistan. At least five citizens were killed in a bomb blast outside a Kabul mosque Sunday, a Taliban official said. It was the deadliest attack in the Afghan capital since U.S. forces left at the end of August. There was no immediate claim of responsibility, but suspicion fell on Islamic State extremists who have stepped up attacks on the Taliban in recent weeks, particularly in an IS stronghold in eastern Afghanistan. An apparent roadside bomb went off at the gate of the sprawling Eidgah Mosque in Kabul at a time when memorial service was being held for the mother of Chief Taliban spokesman Zabuhala Mohajed. Five people were killed, said Qari Saeed Gostai, the spokesman of the Interior Ministry. The explosion underscored the growing challenges the Taliban face just weeks after they took control of Afghanistan on August 15th. Now, briefly, knife attack. Authorities said Sunday a third victim has died following a violent attack where an angry electrician wielding a knife and baseball bat killed three co-workers and injured another Friday at the Florida home they shared. New York. A statue honoring George Floyd in New York City's Union Square Park was vandalized on Sunday, police said. According to police, a video showed an unidentified man on a skateboard throwing paint on the statue at about 10 a.m., then fleeing. Middle East. President Mohammed Abbas hosted Israeli Health Minister Nitzan Horowitz for a late-night meeting Sunday in a new sign of slowly improving ties between the sides. Florida. The suspect in the 2018 killing of 17 people at a Florida high school is finally going on trial, but not for the slayings. Jury selection begins Monday on charges Nicholas Cruz attacked a Broward County jail guard 9 months after the February 14, 2018 shootings at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland. Powerball. The biggest lottery prize in months grew larger after no ticket matched all five numbers in the Powerball drawn on Saturday night. The estimated jackpot for the next drawing on Monday is $670 million. Bridge fire. A blaze, possibly sparked by a gas canister explosion, destroyed part of an historic bridge spanning the Tiber River in Rome before firefighters extinguished the flames early Sunday. Teresa Thomas of the Associated Press files this story. Romans say enough to wild boar invasion, and the story begins with a photograph of wild boars feasting on garbage near trash bins in Rome. Rome has been invaded by Gauls, Visigoths, and Vandals over the centuries, but the Eternal City is now grappling with a rampaging force of an entirely different source. Rubbish-seeking wild boars. Entire families of wild boars have become a daily sight in Rome as groups of 10 to 30 beasts, young and old, emerge from the vast parks surrounding the city to trot down traffic-clogged streets in search of food in Rome's notoriously overflowing rubbish bins. Posting wild boar videos on social media has become something of a sport as exasperated Romans capture the scavengers marching past their stores, strollers, or playgrounds. As Rome gears up for a local election next weekend, the wild boar invasion has been used as a political weapon to attack Mayor Virginia Raggi over the city's formidable garbage collection problems. But experts say the issue is more complicated and tied, at least in part, to a booming boar population. Italy's main agriculture lobby, Coldredi, estimates there are over 2 million wild boars in Italy. The region of Lazio, surrounding Rome, estimates there are 5,000 to 6,000 of them in city parks, a few hundred of which regularly abandon the trees and green for urban asphalt and trash bins. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier, for Monday, October 4th. I'm your reader, Bob Young. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time, and you may wish to stay tuned to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald, which will follow shortly. Thank you for listening to Your Iris, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.